Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Game Dev Unchained, the number one game development podcast about game development and the lifestyle thereof. I am your host, Brandon Pham, and welcoming a special friend again, Jay Wilson. How are you doing, Jay?
I'm good. How are you, Brandon?
I am good, man. It's been a while. You've been one of the earlier episode guests that we've had on before.
Yeah, it's been quite a bit, for sure.
So just as a refresher, for the newbie listeners and viewers out there, this is the part of the podcast where I ask our guests, which is yourself, a little bit about your past, your present, and what your future is looking like. Just a little intro.
Well, so my past, I worked for several companies. I started at Monolith working on first-person shooters, moved to Relic Entertainment working on RTSs, their Dawn of War, Impossible Creatures, Company of Heroes. I was the lead designer or design director on all of those. And then after that, I went to Blizzard, where I was the game director on Diablo 3, and also did a bunch of other things. I redid the combat for World of Warcraft, for Legion, and lots of things I can't talk about because they're all secret. So, yeah.
That is quite a resume, man. Still as impressive, as the second time I heard it. So we never really talked about a particular topic, but I always like to have, I wanted to come on to kind of give like a perspective, right? Especially with how things are now. It feels like a transitional period for game developers. The remote home thing is very foreign to our industry. I would say, you know, a lot of big companies are resistant to that. But now it's, I would say, at least more embraced. And it's kind of changing how we interact with each other and dealing with these huge IPs and being a person like yourself working on these huge IPs where it was unthinkable to think that it can be spread out so far and wide in multiple homes like this. I would love to kind of hear your thoughts of what this last year looked like, how it can affect our industry going forward.
Well, it's interesting for me since I left Blizzard, which I didn't mention, I left Blizzard 4 years ago. I've been working from home, and so it was just kind of more of the same. But what I noticed from the industry as a whole is it kind of depends upon what your job is how much you enjoy the work from home. If your job is primarily to sit at a desk and make things, for the most part, people seem to really be more productive in that process. If your job is to mostly talk to people, which is, a lot of people, a lot of management, a lot of, people who run large studios, they spend a lot of time communicating and enabling communication. And for them, that's obviously a much more challenging situation. So it kind of depends upon who you ask. For me, I think it's a good thing because for the most part, the general sentiment that I've heard is that people think it works better than it doesn't. And there's a lot more willingness to fund studios that are remote and to have remote employees. I think in the long run, it's going to be very difficult to take game development and make it completely remote for a lot of studios. It certainly is possible. There's lots of developers who already do it who've made great games. I off the top of my head, I know the developers of Ori are completely remote. The success of your game doesn't really seem to necessarily relate to that, but communication is so challenging on remote versus doing it when everyone's in the same location that I think you're going to still see a lot of developers who are resistant to it.
What is interesting is that you have this outside perspective, doing this already for the last 4 years and seeing your fellow colleagues discovering this new lifestyle. But you had that time to kind of transition in a more comfortable pace that works for you, because I was remote before this whole thing happened. And, there's a transitional period for all of us, how we separate work from family, how do we separate work from home when you're actually at home. And that is a long process. And I'm still a work in progress to kind of figure out what that balance is to make it work for everybody. But coming from someone that has been a creative director of major franchises, which is the highest position of a creative discipline, the management part of it sounds can be complicated. You were talking about at least the design side of things. You guys like to talk, and it is very difficult. Even conducting these interviews, I've been seeing a shift, because before Zoom was cool, Zoom interviews felt like, obviously you're over there, I'm over here, we got to talk. But now, since everyone is doing 5-6 hours of Zooms, and the interview part, when we get to it, they're still tired of it. There's a huge fatigue bomb with all these meetings kind of piling up. So I would love to kind of hear, going back to handling such a big franchise over online meetings like that. I mean, I know there's a lot of teams are trying to do it right now. And I also hear that it's difficult. There's still a lot of hump to kind of figure out. But I would love to kind of hear your thinking process of more highlighting the issues that either will take a lot of time to figure, or issues that won't be solved anytime soon and needs to have some kind of hybrid approach or something.
Well, I'm actually a big believer in remote. I think that a lot of the time, for a lot of companies, meetings are a big problem, not a big benefit. The meetings are usually held by, I shouldn't be too general, because I don't want to paint with a brush that all meetings are bad and everyone who holds meetings is bad. But I think everyone's worked in a environment where they felt like there were too many meetings or the meetings were unnecessary. And I think in a lot of those cases, there's truth to it. Because a lot of the times we hold meetings when we feel like there is a sense of loss of control. That's game development. You kind of live in a sense of loss of control a lot of the times, because you're dealing with a big team and they're all moving simultaneously, and no one person can kind of keep all that in their head. And I think one of the things that you kind of learn to do as you gain more and more experience is trust in the process. You trust that your people are going to move forward on their own. You trust that that everyone in the process is an adult who can be given adult responsibility. So I think the challenges for remote going forward are a lot more related to how do you replace that communication that both the employees and management need, and how do you collaborate well. I actually think to a lot of degrees, you can look to things like people are using Slack and similar types of programs. And I actually do think that will get you a lot of the way there. I think in terms of leadership and management, there's a much higher responsibility towards being seen within your modes of communication that you have. So if you have Slack, like you really want to be there. You want to post often. You want to keep discussions going. You want to contribute maybe overly, not to try and direct things, but to try and get them moving in the first place. Because it's, I think the hardest thing about remote is not that you can't communicate. The hardest thing about remote is that it's easy to not communicate. And so you want kind of ways and methodology to, or just habits that will get that communication moving. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, definitely. I think remote is here to stay in some form. I truly believe that. It's very hard to kind of show this life to a game developer and then take it away when the pandemic's over, right? I think there's going to be a fight, or at least an understanding that there needs to be changes from a 9-to-5.
And there's there's so many benefits to remote that, I think the downsides that people thought, like people would just sit at home and goof off, like, you know, I just don't think game developers are like that. The word that I hate most in relation to game developers is lazy. People love to use it all the time. They're just too lazy to add that feature. There are lots of flaws you can put on game developers. Lazy is not one of them. I've never met a professional game developer who I thought was lazy. They all had to work really hard to get into the game development industry, and they work really hard once they're there. They're a passionate group of people. So the idea that people are going to goof off, maybe you're going to get, the occasional person who does, maybe. That is the easiest problem to solve, because it'll be very obvious in their work output that they are not working. But in terms of what the real kind of problems with remote relative to the benefits, you know, the fact that you can have a team built from anywhere, that you can have people who you never would be able to hire otherwise because they're not willing to move or relocate. Like, the game industry is small, and as a result, like, if you want to work, you move a lot. And moving is really hard on families. It's really hard on everyone. And so the idea that you could hire a whole team of people and not only not ask them to relocate, but tell them they can live anywhere in the world. Like, they don't have to move to the most expensive place in the world, which a lot of game companies are in, some of the most expensive places in the world. And the fact that you can give them an environment where a good number of people can focus a lot better than they can in a big office environment. The biggest problem I think you run into are, like I said, the communication issues that come up, which I think are solvable. And probably the hardest one is there are some people who do not like it and don't work well within it. And I'm going to be a little on the mean side there and say, welcome to the world of people who don't work well in offices. They've lived in your world all their lives. And, you know, if they could live through that and suck it up and try it out, you can do the same thing.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people being exposed right now in this new time. This actually leads into my next line of questioning. So what happens now, right? So this is the year that I anticipate that at least near the end, we're going to start seeing game developers slowly crawling back into the workforce, into an office, right? Just maybe slivers of it, maybe at the end of the year with the vaccines coming out. I mean, I don't know if you're still in Orange County. I mean, the numbers are pretty crazy right now.
I actually live in Portland, Oregon now.
even better. So the numbers are spiking, but I think everyone is kind of seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, at least where there is seems to be an ending somewhat, right? I would love to kind of hear what you think is going to happen now with part of it is what you said might be a hybrid approach. And part of it is how I guess, pro tips that you think where we are changing, we are going to be working in a new environment, how game devs and teams can be effective in this new type of industry. Same game industry, but a new type of office environment, right? And I completely agree with you. The visibility thinking, it's huge. In the office, you always, it's weird, but you have to, overly say hi to people to make them realize that you actually are there doing work. Otherwise, it's very easy to sit in your cubicle and disappear. And I think a lot of game developers make that mistake. It's like, oh, it's about all about the work, right? As long as my work shows, then I'm good. It's not that, right? So, and then you add this extra element with online connectivity and remote working. And now we're going to see kind of what is the best of both worlds there for a developer or a team to like really navigate through this in a successful way.
Well, I think you're going to see more of a hybrid approach. I think you're going to see a lot more game developers who are okay with people working from home as part of their time working. The benefits are very high. If for no other, you know, I used to spend when I worked at Blizzard, I didn't work that far from Blizzard, and I still lost an hour to an hour and a half every day commuting. And so that's a lot of lost time. But I still think that the benefits of and the natural desire that management has towards towards a single development location is strong. And I think as the pandemic goes away, as we've seen in locations where there are parts of the world where the pandemic is either under control or even completely contained. And if you talk to people from those parts of the world, they're like, everything's like it was before. I think we thrive on normalcy, and we'll move back towards it as quickly as we can. But I do think we'll be one more open towards people working from home. We've already seen some of the big developers, not always in game development, but in technology in general, say, yeah, we're okay with it. I think Google has said, yeah, you can work from home for the foreseeable future, even after the pandemic. So I think we're going to see a lot more of that. I think we're going to see like good managers looking at their people and realizing how they're most productive and putting them in those situations, whether that be work from home, work in the office, or a hybrid. I also think you're going to see a lot more remote studios. So that is going to be a thing. I think it's going to work better with small teams. Just naturally, small teams, communication is less of an issue in general. And as a result, I think remote lends itself to a small team better than it will to. So by small, I mean under 45. I know that's a really specific number, but it's been my experience that there are breakpoints in team size. And 45 is one of those breakpoints. I don't know why it's not 50, but it feels like over 45 is right around where you get this new, like you need another layer of management. You need better to up your communication. And I think probably bigger than that, you're going to find challenges working remote. Not to say it can't work. It's just going to be harder. And so I think you're going to see a lot of smaller studios that are more successful. And for no other reason than it's, again, it's very difficult to get people to move for a small studio. But if you work remote, you can hire from anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm. And actually, speaking of from anywhere in the world, although the remote working is great, and I really do think the people with professionalism and awesome work are never should be never feeling insecure about their job. But overall, we are opening up a barrier of entry where overseas, now that, you know, everybody can connect remotely, unless a studio really has strict rules about time zones, there's a new level of talent that can be invited within a studio setting for any of the disciplines now, and at a fraction of the salary even, right? So from that perspective, I would love to kind of hear your thoughts about how real is that scenario where it used to be, you know, we work with people with visas before and they're super talented and stuff. But now you don't need that. And because of the visa thing, it prevented a lot of talent from getting into these great companies, working on these great projects, right? Good and bad, right? Mostly bad. Yeah.
There still are legal issues with you can't just hire and have someone from another country work for you without working out. I don't know the exact details of that, but it's not as simple, I think, as oh, you no longer need a visa. But that being said, like, there are a lot of scenarios where and already companies where they do that, where they actually have groups that are or individuals that are working on the other side of the world. And from what I've understood, there are a lot of benefits in, you think of it like, oh, well, that's a downside because one group is working at a different time than another group. And so their ability to communicate is not as good because of the difference there, you know, like one person sleeping when another group is awake. But actually, from what I've heard, the group, when one group sunsets, the other group starts and can address issues for the group that is off. And so you get this interesting back and forth that I from what I understand, is can work quite well. But yeah, I think that I think the idea that if you have a remote company, you can hire from a much broader talent set and from a much broader geographical, you know, I don't know the words I was meant to, I was going to say words there, and I don't know the words I was going to say, but from anywhere in the world, basically, that idea, well, yeah, that's why you do remote, like you, because you can hire from anywhere in the world. And I don't, when I say like, oh, you can hire from anywhere, I really do mean, I'm not just talking about anywhere in the US or anywhere in North America. I do really think like, oh yeah, you hire from anywhere, because from every company I've ever worked for, we've always hired from all over the world. I've never worked in a studio where we didn't have people from Europe, people from Australia, people from Asia who we pulled into the company. I can't imagine that it would be more difficult remote. It seems like it would be easier if for no other reason you don't have to talk somebody into leaving their life behind.
Yeah, definitely. I recently, like everybody, just went on like a 2-week holiday break, right? And it's something I always look forward to every year as a game developer. It's just like a time to kind of just unplug and just be away from it and just see what other joys of life I can find and discover or rediscover every Christmas, right? And I think it is a healthy, I think it should be longer. I think it should be more frequent throughout the year because it is a very stressful job. And I equate every project to be like a sprint in a race, one after another, until there is some rest, right? Which is, you know, the game cycles are getting longer and longer. So you took 4 years away from the industry. I would love to kind of hear what that feels like, because even with my 2 weeks, I always equate it to not long enough, but long enough to get the itch, the creative urge to do something again, to make a game or work on a project, right? And I love that feeling. And I always also enjoy and think about, you know, what is a long break from doing other things? Because creatively, I think it helps as well to get back into it and come up with new ideas, especially as a designer such as yourself. So I would love to kind of hear your you know, what was year one, year two, year three, not in crazy detail, but just general feelings about what that was like being in the industry for so long.
Well, not working is great work if you can get it for a while. Mm-hmm. Now that being said, I spent, you know, 3 years working on novels. So I wouldn't say I was exactly not working, but I wasn't working in the game industry. And it's a very different kind of work. It's different in terms of time frame. It's different in terms of what it asks from you. And because ultimately I'm my own employer, I can take a break whenever I feel like it, which is great. But you know, the thing I would tell anybody who doesn't want to work anymore is make sure you know what you're going to do with your time. Cause it, you know, I very quickly kind of went, I really liked what I'm doing right now, but I miss game development. You know, I miss working with a team. I don't really care for working alone, for all. And what I found is I do like writing, and I can try to accommodate both. At this point, I can write very quickly, so I do believe I can accommodate both. But in terms of what it's like to kind of, it's actually really hard. Boo-hoo, you didn't have to work for 4 years. It does, after a while, it kind of feels, and I think everybody who is stuck either not working or working from home during the pandemic will probably can relate now, that you can start to feel like, you know, you got ants crawling under your skin after a while. Like, you really, you know, I don't think humans are designed to not do things. I think we're designed to, you know, people always say, like, well, how did they build the pyramids? And I'm like, you get a bunch of bored people sitting around, they will do crazy stuff. And I think that's the ultimate kind of takeaway that I've gotten from not working for a little bit, is I like working. It's nice taking some time off. It's nice to get perspective. The game industry burns people out like crazy. So the thing I would tell people too is, if you feel burnt out, take some time, you know, if you can find a way, do something else for a few years. You know, the game industry will still be there when you come back. Like, they're not going anywhere.
Hey guys, let's take a break and have a word from our sponsor. This episode is sponsored by AppFigures. AppFigure is all about giving game makers the tools they need to get more downloads and revenue. You may already know them for analytics and app store optimization. Now, AppFigures can help you track competitors, from how many downloads they're getting and how much money they're making, to their audience demographics, and even which SDKs they use. Their competitor intelligence gives you great context. Say a competitor adds a new feature or was mentioned in the news. With AppFigures, you can see if that brought in more downloads. Got a great idea for an app or a game? With AppFigures, you can figure out how big the market is and how much money you could be making with it. And that's just scratching the surface. Whether you're growing your app or building a new one, AppFigures has the tools you need to reduce risk and get more downloads. You don't need a large budget or a data science degree to do this kind of stuff anymore. AppFigures has made it affordable and simple. On top of tools, AppFigures also provides a lot of guides and tutorials to take you step by step through gaining more visibility with ASO and increasing your revenue by learning from your competitors. They just released a free guide on that, actually. So head over to appfigures.com, appfigures.com/on. /gamedevunchained to try AppFigures for free. If you like it, then use our special code GDU3030 to get 30% off for the next 3 months. You're welcome. Yeah, I think one of the aspects that are starting to be discussed and working from home, yeah, I felt that way too. There's a mental toll that comes with it. And this is before the pandemic, where I'm freely available to go outside. But my social interaction quickly diminished. You know, you're not hanging out with your friends. There's that water cooler moment or that break room stuff. You know, just those little interactions add up throughout the day. Completely gone when you work from home. And now, you know, times that by 10, people can't go outside or go anywhere where they normally would. And, you know, it affects everybody of all age group. And it's very difficult, I think. I hope creatively there's something amazing that's going to come out of this, because I really believe behind limiting people. I wonder what kind of creative projects that are going to come out of this pandemic. But at this point, it's like hitting an expiration point. It's like, it's not worth it. Like, I'd rather be outside. Constantly like that. Yeah.
I, you know, got up here because I moved from California to Portland, as I think I mentioned. And like, I'm in three D&D groups, one of which I run. I started spending a lot of time modding games just for my own, you know, benefit, my own, mm-hmm. you know, satisfaction. So, you know, I'm not sure I ever truly left. I just did it in my own way on my own time. I think time off is good for what it does to your mindset. And I do think as an industry, we need to be a lot more realistic about how long it takes to do things and how much time off refreshes the creative juices of our people. I can't tell you how many times I hear like, well, you can't do that in that amount of time. Like, that's just not, you know, that's too long. That's, you know, a death for a company, or that's death for a dev team. Like, you know, that's, you just have to find a way to do it faster. And I'm like, okay, well, you're going to tell a dev team that they've got to do it faster, but I promise you it will take them longer. And when you get there 2 years down the road and they're not done, you're not going to throw those 2 years away. So you're just going to add more time on. Why don't you just be honest about how long it takes up front? But people overall aren't but I don't know a project. There are projects that are finished on time and on budget. But I believe that those projects were realistically budgeted and realistically scheduled. But most of the time, projects don't hit their timeframes or their budget. And sometimes that's mismanagement, and sometimes that's just unrealistic scheduling.
Yeah.
I think most of the time it's unrealistic scheduling, personally.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would love to kind of discuss this with you, actually. I think you're a perfect candidate. You know, cyberpunk is a great example of this. I think what makes that story different for a while is because it's ushering a new generation of games, right? For the new console. And appropriately so, we're kind of looking towards that as, what is the new model here? Is it the same thing as before? Or is it, you know, times 10 in effort and everything, but like the team is still the same size, right? So this is a team that, long dev cycle, 8 years. And I believe it's the response is just far greater than I've ever seen on a game before, where consoles are literally pulling it off of online shelves after it was bought and refunding it. Never seen that before. It is quite new. And it's exposing a lot of the issues that we are used to, right? But I think under a magnifying glass. I would love to kind of get your general thoughts about that. You know, being one yourself that have managed large teams like this, who are kind of used to longer dev cycles, to deadlines that feel short, should be longer. I mean, it's. I'll be loving to kind of hear your take on it.
Well, I think the first thing I'll say is that my heart goes out to CD Projekt. Yeah. You know, they're in a position that is very, very tough. I can say, like, to anybody who's angry at them, I would say there are a significant percentage of the lives of these people they've put towards this game. Like, there are probably people on that game where they can say 25% or a third of my life I spent working on this game, depending on their ages. And that's not a small thing. Like, it's their lives, and nobody there wanted a bad release. In terms of the why, it's so difficult to choose your time of release. It's very difficult to defend the PS4 and Xbox One stuff. Like, you should be able to just look and see that it can't run. Like, that's really hard to defend. But you know, you do reach a point with development where you have to take a gamble on, are we done? And those big, giant, complicated projects, you know, they can go on exponentially. And there's never, if you ask the development team truly, there is never a point where they will feel the game is done. They may do all kinds of, like, 6 months from now, we may all be looking back and going, oh, they released a couple patches and now Cyberpunk's awesome. And I actually think that is what's going to happen. Maybe the time frame isn't 6 months, maybe it's 12 months. But I actually think that they will make good on Cyberpunk. And we're going to be playing an awesome game. It's not that far off. It really is, on a lot of levels, kind of a mind-blowing accomplishment. It's just got a few things that I can see why they would gamble on. And you know, I could see why they'd go, you know, let's do this. We think we can fix that before release, or we think we can, we think maybe that's not as big a deal as we, because you got to remember, the dev team, they're so much closer to it than the audience is. Then they don't, there's a lot of things that they see it through a completely different filter. It's a tough position, because on the one hand, like, I don't want to defend, like, developers releasing games before they're done. On the other hand, I don't think any developer wants to do that either. And I think when they do that, they do it under, for lack of a better term, duress. You really can't, I can't express enough the pressure that is put upon a developer to release a game by everyone, including themselves. The audience, before the game is out, will tell the developer anything. We don't care about such and such. We don't care about, like, we just want the game. Just give us the game. Whoa, you know, death threats and all this stuff. Like, you just get this almost, you know, cacophony of release the game. And it's not a very great environment for making kind of calm, rational decisions. And so as a result, sometimes people make mistakes. People aren't perfect. I hope people judge the Cyberpunk developers based upon where Cyberpunk ends up, as opposed to how it released. Because I think that I just have a lot of confidence. Like, they are a company that has always done the right thing by their games. And I believe that they will do the right thing by this one.
Yeah, I think I'm in full agreement as well. That they have enough goodwill and a track record to completely turn this around and complete it to the state that they wanted. It is earlier than they expected in terms of release. I'm playing through it. I'm playing it on PC. I think that's everyone's first mistake. Why are you playing on a PS4? And it looks great. And there are bugs, obviously. And you can definitely see semblance of, oh, yeah, this is part of something amazing here. As they just need more time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm playing it on PC as well. And I think what we when a release is troubled, what people often don't do is look at everything that's right. Like everything that Cyberpunk has done, that like no one's built a city like that before. Like it's astounding. The story, I really enjoy the story. I think the story's great. And they've captured like the feel of Cyberpunk. Like they you know, in a way that I don't think anyone ever really has in a game. Like they've done so much right. That it's just hair-pullingly frustrating for everyone, again, including the developers, especially the developers, the few things that are wrong. And there will be people who will never forgive them for that. And I would say to those people, like, why? Like, why not? If you eventually are going to get the game you wanted, why not forgive them? Like, if you eventually get a great game, you know, that's what matters more than anything, because for the most part, they're just not that far. Like I can see why they released. They're not that far away from something really great. And yeah, there's lots of bugs and other things. Welcome to those games. Like what Bethesda game doesn't have a lot of bugs? I'm sure they're sick of hearing about it, but when you make a game that complicated, it's just going to happen. And as long as those bugs are not game breakers, and granted, I know that there are so few that were fixed very quickly, by the way, then that's just, do I think it's right? Of course not. Of course not. Like, I don't think anybody thinks it right, including the developers. But I think when you make a game that's that complicated, we're not at a place yet where we can always make those bug-free. And the developers who do make games that are that big and complicated that are relatively bug-free, you know, they probably have a long history of making those types of games. And so they have they've got a lot of practice at doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the funniest comparison videos that I'm seeing a lot after that backlash is it's being compared to Red Dead, which is unfair. It's being compared to Assassin's Creed games. It's like, guys, these guys, you know, this is the first biggest game that they've ever done, and it's the first time they didn't do it with trees, right? So it's like full-on city. It's a very tough thing. And I think there is a discrepancy both from the gamer and game developer side, because they're getting backlash from both sides. The gamer side, you know, I think there is a deteriorating notion attributed to AAA, because they're seeing so much of this now with the Andromeda, Mass Effect, all this stuff in recent years, buying games that are broken from day one. Right. So they feel like they're being cheated. On the other side, I'm seeing it from the game developer complaining about why these games can't be done on time. Why do we have to crunch? And it's a weird, I'm always finding myself in the middle. It's like, and I always use Red Dead as an example. That's another game that's infamously crunching. And that took them 8 years. And this is an experienced team, right? And I look at that game and I'm still playing through it. And I'm just like, and it's like 3 years old, 5 years old, pretty old game. And I'm looking around. I'm like, how did they make this? It is impossible for them to not to do this in 8 years and not crunch to get it to this. It is so impressive that they got it to this state, because even normally that would stretch even longer to do it correctly in a timely manner.
I don't know that I think it's impossible. I think it's actually quite possible. I just think that this industry is still young.
Yeah.
And so managing, like, how many games the size of Red Dead Redemption 2 or Cyberpunk have been made?
Yeah.
Like, the film industry has made a lot of 100 million plus budget giant blockbuster movie. They have it down to a science. It's astounding how quickly, to me, they can make them. But they, you know, they have a methodology, you know, that they also have, you know, revenue that that justifies. And so you, we're just at a point where people are still learning on how to make those giant, giant games and make them efficiently. And the truth is, I don't think we know how to make them efficiently. For the most part, there are, you know, I can certainly point to some games that I would say that's a pretty damn big game that is relatively bug free, like Spider-Man. Yeah. Man, hats off. The new God of War, the last one, amazing. Those games feel rock solid. Now, I don't know how long those games took to make. Maybe they took 7-8 years as well. But they don't feel like they went through quite the length and process. But, you know, with, you know, I've worked on games that have taken a lot longer than they felt they should have. And in almost every case, it was because we were dealing with massive unknowns, and made choices that, because of our lack of knowledge, turned out to be the wrong choices and cost us time and energy. And so, you know, now I can go back to any game, almost any game I've made, except for probably Dawn of War, because Dawn of War was made extremely efficiently. But almost any game I've made, I could go back and make it quicker. You know, I had a boss, Rob Pardo at Blizzard, who told me once, "Yeah, you're going to be really good at making this game around the time that you're done making this game." And it's true. And that's why I think for a lot of people, a lot of development teams, you often see it's their second game, you know, that is amazing, or takes a big leap over the first, because they learn so much through that development process.
Yeah, that's naturally leading into my next question. Now, and talking about the first things we were talking about, and maybe it's just a working theory, so play with me here. You know, the moving thing was real. The thing about traveling artists, every game developer is going to the best job all the time. So that also means, you know, there's a high turnover rate, low retention rate at every company. And these big budget games are, you know, always getting bigger. But in a lot of these sequels, it's like whole different teams, or at least part a hybrid of new and old, right? So we don't have, let's say, the first team kind of leading into the second team of, we've done this before, here's to do it again, but add a little more. And so that kind of throws, I don't know, every lesson learned away. And that causes a lot of issues during production. And I don't know if maybe remote will fix a lot of that problem, where not a lot of people would be inclined to leaving all the time. I wonder in this generation, and I would love to hear your opinion of, is that going to be solved? Because I feel like that really does help. With films, those guys usually travel together. It's like always the same crew. It's this very small circle. So it's very easy to kind of move on and work on another project with another director, but it's the same crew, so they know what they're doing. With games, I don't feel like we have that as much. I think from all my friends all the way back from 2K to Sledgehammer, everyone has been spread out every single time. I don't know a team that has stayed together very long, unfortunately. And I would love to kind of hear your thoughts about that.
I don't think that is a people quitting issue. That is a how development studios run kind of issue, and also the process for how you make a game. So you make a game, and over the process of making that game, your team grows and grows and grows as you need more and more people to finish the game. You reach the end, and then you go to the beginning of a new game, and you know, depending on the size of your team, anywhere from 50 to 80, 90% of your team, you don't need. Like you don't need a full production team when you're trying to figure out the very beginning of your game. Like when you're at the very, very beginning trying to work out. Now, if you, that's one issue. So, the tendency is let's spread these people out to other places. There's often other teams that desperately need help because they are starting to gear up towards their release. And so the tendency is to, take these people and put them, say, well, this thing's on fire over here. We're going to take these people and they're going to fight fires on this other project. And as a result, like you end up kind of unintentionally tearing up the teams. I actually felt like Blizzard was really good about this for the most part. They actually kept teams together, and sometimes at the cost of that cost to the company, because the team would be bigger than you need. They would pull some people, but they'd also do, instead of just saying like, oh, we're going to take this person and now you're on the World of Warcraft team or you're on the Overwatch team, we would loan people. We would say, you're going to go work on WoW for 6 months and then you're going to come back. And that way the team still stayed more intact. And actually there was a big benefit because you go to a different team and you'd learn how they do things, and then you could bring back your learning to your original team. And then what we would do is spend that time, even though like we had a large team, we would support the game we just released with patches and new content, and we'd start expansions, and then a chunk of the team would start working on what the new game was going to be. That model worked pretty well. It is not the most efficient. But in terms of the short term, it seems like, why do we have people just, not working super hard when we've got other people in the company doing like killing themselves? But in the long run, it actually benefits greatly because you keep those teams together, you keep communication. Once a team has worked together for a while, they learn how to work together, and it has a huge benefit. That long-term benefit can be kind of easy to overlook because it's long-term. Like you don't see it right away, but it's worth it. I really think that methodology was good. Like that, loan people out, but keep teams together. Occasionally people would leave when they were done, which is understandable. Sometimes you spend a long time on something, you want to do something new. But for the most part, teams were kept together, and the effort was towards, well, let's find work for everyone to do while we have a small nucleus start on the new game.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think there's no coincidence a company like Valve, like Blizzard, have like this continued success with either old IPs or new IPs. And a lot of that I can only attribute to the team staying together. And that is like a very privileged and very smart strategy position to be in. I think a lot of developers are just trying to get that one hit under their belt, right? So yeah. it's very hard to have like so many hits just like Blizzard to be able to cycle through developers.
I do think though, a lot of the times people will attribute to Blizzard like, well, they're like, well, they're just, that's Blizzard. So you can't, you know, nobody else can do that. It's just Blizzard. And my response is, no, anyone can do it. Yeah. Like anyone can do it. It's not nearly as privileged as people might think. The truth is, when you keep a chunk of your team treating your game like a live service, no, is there a direct monetization to that? That you can easily measure? Arguably, no. I could argue there is, but the truth is, the more your game is supported, the more your game will continue to sell.
Yeah.
And that, I think we're seeing that now. Like we're seeing that now in you know, if you look at especially like small indie companies and they release in early access and the early access version of their game feels like a finished game. And then they do regular updates that, you know, every, you know, 2 months, 3 months, there's bam, 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 regular update that comes out. I know having spoken to some of those companies, they often sell as much or more in their second year of release than their first. And that is unheard of. Mm-hmm. Yeah, normally you release a game, the lion's majority of your sales, unless you have some kind of multiplayer or continuing like game as a service element, the vast majority of your sales are in month one and that's, you're done. But yeah, no, these companies, just because they continue to support and release, and it brings back streamers, it brings back audience that is loyal, and there's no resistance coming back because they've already bought the game. But truth is, more people playing your game, the more new people are going to buy your game. And so that's actually a true statement for any developer. Like all I see, early access to me, for a lot of these companies, is no different than the way Blizzard would release a game and then support that game after. It's just that, you know, we don't call it that. We call it early access. And so I don't think that the privileged kind of place that Blizzard operates from is nearly as privileged as people say it is. I think it's an excuse a lot of the times, especially when you've got somebody who's like a huge developer with a large coffers of cash. They did not have to release that game early. Like they didn't have to, they could have held off. They could have supported that game a little longer, but they just didn't. They didn't want to. They wanted to put their money somewhere else. And, you know, maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong. But in my opinion, it's better to support what you have than if you truly believe in it. And if you don't truly believe in it, why'd you make it in the first place?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the Cyberpunk team is feeling really wrong right now. But I completely agree with you. I think a lot of these issues is...
But we have no idea what their position is. Like, they're a private company. They don't I don't know what their financials are. Nobody does. But I mean, I believe their primary financials are the Witcher series. Mm-hmm. They have a giant team to support. Those teams burn money at an enormous rate. Like we don't know what their situation is. Mm-hmm. And as a result, and again, like it's hard to defend a troubled release on the one hand. On the other hand, there's enough people piling on to them that I'm going to go the other route.
The other way around.
We just don't know. And
what went wrong. Yeah.
And I don't, I think it's perfectly fine for people to be mad, like, and for people to feel like the product is not what it should be. But I also think the proper response to it is, this is not what we hoped. What are you guys going to do about it?
Yeah.
And if you do the right thing, then we'll support it as a community.
I think No Man's Sky is a perfect example.
No Man's Sky is a perfect example. People forget that Destiny was really painful when it first came out.
Very
and then
painful.
6 months later, all everybody talked about was Destiny.
Yeah.
Honestly, it seems like about every 6 months, Destiny is the worst game in the world. And suddenly, like 3 months later, the greatest game in the world.
I think a lot of this is a definition problem. Just call everything an early release from now on, and people will be more forgiving. It's like, I get it. I mean, they're patching it already.
Yeah. There's so many like early access games. Like, I'm like, that's not an early access. That's a
that's a done game.
That's a done game that they're just going to continue to add features to.
Yeah. That's why I always feel like it's always helpful to look at other parts of the industry that is, I feel like they're fixing a lot of the issues already. Like the mobile industry is a good example. They test their game design first before, you know, really monetizing it or really investing into it. The indie teams are finding solutions as well to figure out how to to survive and still be paying the bills and all this stuff. And I do feel out of all parts of the industry, AAA is still, they've done better in the past year with, I mean, loot boxes had a bad taste in the mouth now, but I mean, that was a good in the right, you know, there was something there, obviously, in the DLC, all this stuff. We were trying to incorporate a lot of this stuff, but in a large portion of it, very old school and how, you know, once the game is out, that's how you make money and then you work on another game and that's it.
Yeah, but I mean, I think if you look at AAA, it's the hardest.
It's the hardest, yep.
The least turnaround. Like, you look at Grounded, the game from, and granted, Obsidian's owned by Microsoft, but Grounded is basically made like an indie game. I think they had
small team,
8 to 12, somewhere in that range. I don't know exactly. It's a tiny team. They had, 2 million players in the first 48 hours, something like that?
Mm-hmm.
That's a massive turnaround. Like, that profit-wise, that's enormous. Mobile games, you know, everybody knows, like, the profit margins on those. That's why so much of the industry focuses on them. I do think there's an issue there of, so much of the industry is focused on them that actually turns around and becomes you end up with a lot more failures because the market can only support so much. But regardless, when you have a hit as a mobile game, your return on investment is ridiculous.
Yeah.
When you have a giant hit as a AAA game, you're still never going to get return on investment.
Yep.
In scale with something like a mobile game or an indie game, something that was made with a small team. And I think that's one of the things, I think outside of game development, game developers, this is not big news to them, but for, game players, for the gaming community, never really been an understanding of like how much it costs to make games and how difficult it can be to get the kind of return that is expected in the business world nowadays. You could say that is unrealistic in and of itself. But what it comes down to is, if you have a company that can make $1 million profit, which is, by the way, $1 million, nothing in terms of game development. It's Coke money. And by Coke, I don't mean
yeah, yeah. I mean the soda. Yeah.
If you've, I'm gonna use bigger numbers. If you have a project that can make $100 million and cost 10, versus a project that can make $100 million and cost 50,
yeah.
Why wouldn't you make the one that costs 10? Yeah. Like, and the answer right now is really comes down to two things. One is that those are the games that have the impact on our culture. You know, people don't talk about mobile games in terms of their cultural impact, but things like Red Dead have cultural impact. Like they move us as humans. That has a lot of value to, and unfortunately, like it's business. I wish it wasn't, but it is, because it's a business that's got to have value. And it does. Thankfully, it has value to, you know, Sony wants to release exclusives that the world talks about because it raises Sony's prestige. And that matters to them. It has a dollar amount at the end of the day that matters to them. And then the rest of the reason is because we have dreamers. We have people who dream big and shoot for the stars, and good for them. But that's it. Like, there's so many better arguments for doing mobile free-to-play development or doing indie development than there are for doing AAA development. And that's something I think we should keep in mind if we want AAA development to stick around.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic note to end this podcast. And I completely agree with you. I think as a game developer, there's a narcissistic quality to ourselves. I want to see my game enjoyed mm-hmm. in a shorter time frame. I don't want to wait a decade before people know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And I think overall that helps with the business model of things.
I don't think that's crazy. Narcissistic. I think that I really think that game developers want to bring joy to the world. Like they want to see people happy and having a good time. And I think that that's, I don't think that's narcissistic. I think that that's
it's a great quality to have. We're entertainers. We want to entertain.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, and that's what it comes down to is, and it's tough because, you know, entertainers have, you know, not a tradition of the most, rock, hard concrete egos mm-hmm. and personalities. We tend to be a fragile bunch, but we're not, you know, in this day and age, like you're just supposed to take whatever comes at you, like whatever abuse, it doesn't matter. You just suck it up. That's the internet.
Yeah.
And, you know, but that's, you know, entertainers, I don't think have changed in that element, but at the end of the day, like, they still dedicate their lives to trying to make other people happy. And a lot of them benefit a lot less than people might think.
Yeah. And I think this industry, if anything, has been a welcome benefit to the pandemic with people stuck at home and trying to look for that escape. And
tell me about it.
Yeah. It's for me personally, it's been helpful. I want to congratulate you. Go ahead.
Play games has actually gotten smaller for the first time.
Wow. Steam wish lists are actually being conquered all over the world this past year. But I want to thank you for coming on to the podcast, giving us an hour of your wisdom and time. This is the part where I hand the mic over to you and shut up to promote, give attention to, shout out to anybody, anything that you want to talk about.
All right. Well, the first thing I would say is I did spend part of this 4 years off writing a novel. It is called Dead Man Detective, and it is a paranormal mystery. So if you like ghosts and mysteries, and then it's not a game related thing, but it is from what I'm told by my readers, a pretty good read, and it's up on Amazon, and it's spelled exactly like it sounds, Dead Man Detective. I go by J.P. Wilson, so I can have that website. I have another announcement that I can't make yet, but I am getting back into game development, and I'm hoping if things work out the way I want, I will have a big announcement soon, but it hasn't reached that point yet.
Awesome. Well, I'm definitely going to check that out. I don't know what the announcement is, but I would have to, like, I'm looking forward to read the book, and books are a great source of inspiration for creative endeavors. Hopefully, you know, one day we can see that into the game, who knows. But I want to thank you for your time, man. Thank you for coming back on. It's good to see you after all these years, and have a good one, everybody. Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you are liking the podcast, go to the Apple iTunes store and give Game Dev Unchained a 5-star rating. This will help spread the joy and love and exposure for the podcast, and we thank you very much. If you want to continue the conversation, go to our Discord, which can be found on our website, www.gamedevunchained.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at BlueChamps, BlueChamps. You want to catch these episodes live every Tuesdays and Thursdays, go to twitch.tv/blue_champs. Email me any of your concerns or questions that you want me to read aloud at the beginning of each episode at info@gamedevunchained.com. And if you want to further support us and help unlock the next feature, which is the voicemail feature, go to patreon.com/BlueChamps. This gives listeners a chance to kind of call in, leave a message for both me and the guests to answer your deepest, darkest questions and comment on your deepest, darkest secrets. Thank you, everybody.